Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What deserves reverence in this world, and how do you identify those things for yourself? People of faith often look to religious doctrine to guide their sense of what is sacrosanct, while some fully secular thinkers try to interpret the world by breaking it down enough to fit neatly into the rational disciplines of modern science. But my guest today says that kind of reductionism robs humans of their inherent spirituality, which he says exists with or without belief in a supernatural God. Stuart A. Kaufman is the founding director of the Institute for Biocomplexity and Informatics, and he's a professor at the University of Calgary. His new book is called Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. Stuart, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So you don't believe in a personal God figure. Why do you also find it hard to swallow the idea that the universe could be fully explained by physical laws?
That's a long and complicated question.
Hence the book.
Just one second, please.
Sure.
My cell phone rang. I forgot to turn it off.
Okay.
The short answer to it requires me to tell you about Darwinian pre-adaptations, Chris, which takes a few minutes and is the, in a way, it's the centerpiece of the book. How do you want to do this?
Well, let's start with pre-adaptations, which are basically things that will ultimately function later on as things evolve, but couldn't be predicted at the time that they first existed.
Yeah, that's right. Can I lay a little groundwork?
Please do.
Okay. So we in the West live with the scientific worldview called reductionism. It starts really with Kepler and Galileo and Descartes, and then the triumph of Newton on down through Einstein and Schrodinger and quantum mechanics, and culminates in the Standard Model in particle physics and in general relativity and in the Genome Project and so on. Stephen Weinberg, a Nobel laureate, puts it this way. He says, the explanatory arrows all point downward from societies to people to organs to cells to biochemistry to chemistry to physics. Now, the first thing about this to notice is that if Weinberg is right, we think we know what it will mean to understand everything when the science shall have been done, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say that that's wrong. If I'm right, which is where you're starting us, if I'm right, and thousands of people that I've talked to seem to think that I'm right, that doesn't prove it. We'll see what your listeners think. It may mean that 400 years of how we've thought about science is wrong, and that we have to if that's true, Chris, it changes everything. So we're talking about not only spirituality, we're talking about our entire worldview. So let me build towards it. Simon-Pierre Laplace, a French mathematician at Napoleon's time, stated it this way. He said, imagine a vast intelligence, not a god, a vast intelligence that knows the positions and velocities of all the particles in the universe. Then that intelligence, said Laplace, could compute using Newton's laws the entire future and the entire past of the universe, because he'd know how all the particles would collide with one another and bounce around. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There are three aspects to Laplace's statement, which is the simplest statement of reductionism. The first is that it's deterministic, because Newton's laws are deterministic. That's given up about a century later when we discover quantum mechanics, which on the most famous Copenhagen interpretation is not deterministic, it's chance. That's Einstein saying, you know, worrying about God playing dice with the universe. The second is that Laplace is clearly saying that everything that happens in the universe is describable by laws, in this case, Newton's laws, okay?
Right.
It's that I'm going to challenge. The third is the notion that it's a nothing but reductionism, in which we are nothing but particles in motion, that the only thing that's real in the universe are particles in motion. So this conversation is just particles in motion. a couple in love walking on the banks of the Seine is nothing but particles in motion. The only thing that's real are particles in motion. Everything else is not real.
But our consciousness tells us that's not possible.
Well, my consciousness tells me it's not possible, but good reductionists may still hold to Laplace's view, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the next step is that there's been a movement away from reductionism, even by the physicists. So about half physicists are still reductionists and about half are not. The half that are not now think that there's something different. It's called emergence. And those are things that cannot be reduced to particle physics. So Phil Anderson, a Nobel laureate physicist, started this in 1972 with an article called More is Different. And recently, Nobel laureate Robert Laughlin has written a book called A Different Universe, The Universe from the Bottom Down, in which he argues that there are emergent phenomena. I'll give a simple example that he gives. A single iron atom isn't rigid, but an iron bar is. So he calls that an emergent property. And then he has in mind what he calls organizational laws, and we probably won't have time to give any examples of that. I argue the same thing in this book. Consider your heart, Chris. It's a very specific organization of matter and stuff that pumps blood, right?
Absolutely.
I'll grant, for the sake of argument, to Weinberg that he could explain all of the causal properties of your heart. But he could not pick out the fact that the function of the heart, as Darwin would tell us, is to pump blood, that's why it occurred in the biosphere. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that you can get that from just looking at all the properties of the heart. The physicists can't say why pumping blood is especially interesting compared to wiggling water in the pericardial sac.
So
what I say in the book is what the physicists cannot do is deduce or simulate the specific evolution of this specific biosphere and confirm it. There's just no way to do so because of the mixture of quantum events and classical events. For example, cosmic rays from outer space can cause mutations which alter the biosphere. How possibly could we ever simulate that? And then I'm going to get to the point that you started us with. So now that I've told you, and let's say it again, a Darwinian adaptation is, for example, your heart pumping blood. And Darwin would say the reason that that's the function of the heart is the heart was selected to do that. Clear enough?
Right.
Okay. But your heart makes heart sounds and wiggles water in your pericardial sac. So Darwin's idea is that an organ might have a property of no use whatsoever in the current environment, but that might turn out to be useful in some funny, different environment, and hence be selected. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's a Darwinian pre-adaptation. I'm going to give two biological examples, and if you'll allow me a moment later, I'll give an economic example. Okay?
Great. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the first example is, you know, you have middle ear bones, the incus, malleus, and stapes, that transmit sound from your eardrum to your inner ear.
Right.
They evolved from three adjacent jaw bones in some fish about 450 million years ago. So that's a Darwinian pre-adaptation. Notice, first of all, that the spatial relations among the bones mattered. Had one been in the skull, one in the spine, and one in the jaw, you wouldn't have gotten the middle ear bones, right?
Right.
Almost certainly not. Okay, hold that in mind. Now, the first question is, did a new function come to exist in the biosphere, hearing, rather than chewing? Well, yeah, it did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Second, did it alter the evolution of the biosphere? Well, of course it did, new species and new molecules. So that's our first pre-adaptation. The second one is a little easier to see. There's an organ in fish called a swim bladder, partially filled with air, partially filled with water. The height of the water adjusts neutral buoyancy in the water column. Okay?
So the fish moves up and down at will.
Yeah, when it wants to be, by putting more water into the swim bladder, it adjusts where it's neutrally buoyant. And as it moves up and down, it changes that. Here's how it's thought to have evolved. There are fish with lungs in them called lungfish, not so astonishingly. And what people think happens, paleontologists think happened, is that water got into the lungs of lungfish. But now you've got a sack with water and air in it. It's almost a swim bladder. It's on its way to becoming a swim bladder. So that's another pre-adaptation. I think it's an easy one to visualize. Again, did a new function come to exist in the biosphere, adjusting neutral buoyancy in the water column? Well, Chris, I think you'll agree the answer is yes, okay?
Now, let me interrupt you for a minute, because some people who don't find it impossible to believe in both evolution and in a sort of creator God would say, well, these are signs that there is some sort of intelligent force that anticipated all of this.
Well, yes, they might want to. Darwin, when he said pre-adaptation, did not mean that there was any intentional design or purpose at all. It just turns out that. It turns out to be useful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that somebody who believes that there's a God outside of space and time was the theistic God isn't directing everything. Okay, that person can continue to believe that, but that's not what scientists believe. Okay?
Right.
Sorry I'm saying okay so much.
Well, we're listening, so don't worry.
I'm a little bit... I'm tired. I slept on the floor last night.
Oh, my goodness.
So now let's again ask, did a new function come to exist? Yes. Adjusting neutral buoyancy in the water column. Did it have causal consequences? Sure, new species and new molecules, new proteins, for example. Now I'm going to come to my central question, Chris. It's where you started. And I ask all of your listeners to think what they really think about this. Here it is. Do you think you could say ahead of time what all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations are for all organisms alive now or just for humans? Chris, what do you think?
Well, I would imagine you couldn't really say what the pre-adaptations are for anything.
Right. Everybody agrees with you, Chris. Including me.
This is so rare for me. So this is a good. It's a good thing for me.
Yeah. Well, thousands of people have now agreed with me. Let me say why I think it's why we can't do it. First of all, the relationships among things like the three jawbones matter. So bearing that in mind, first of all, how could we possibly pre-specify all selective conditions? And how could we possibly pre-specify those one or several features within one or several organisms that might turn out to be pre-adaptations in some wacky environment? There just seems to be no way of doing it at all. You agree?
Absolutely. And clearly, if we could, you wouldn't want them to come with the side effects that so many adaptations from evolution sort of carry with them.
If there were a designer.
Right.
Right. Okay, so now... Everybody seems to accept the claim that we cannot pre-state pre-adaptations. This is going to have radical consequences. If what we all say here is correct, it fundamentally changes our view of Western science. So watch what follows from this, Chris. It's just amazing.
Well, that amazing information will come from Stuart A. Kaufman after our break. He is founding director of the Institute for Biocomplexity and Informatics and a professor at the University of Calgary. His new book is called Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stuart A. Kaufman. His newest book is called Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Stuart, before the break, we got to the idea that we cannot pre-state Darwinian pre-adaptations. Where do we go from there?
Okay. This is a huge conclusion. Let's pause for a moment and just ask, are we sure? Well, everybody agrees, and now let me be a scientist. How could we prove it? Well, would we do an experiment? Well, that sounds nutty. I mean, what experiment would we do? So that seems out. Could we prove a theorem about it, Chris? Maybe. But it's not obvious that we can. There is, in mathematics, a famous theorem called Gödel's theorem, in which in the 1930s, logician Gödel proved that if you have a set of axioms, like for arithmetic, that there are true statements in arithmetic that cannot be proved from the axioms. Mm-hmm. So this kind of thing happens in mathematics, and it's wonderful. But he had a mathematical framework called arithmetic. Now let me define for you the adjacent possible of the biosphere. The swim bladder could come to exist once there were lungfish. It was in the adjacent possible. What could come up next in the biosphere? Okay. Suppose that there were no lungfish, then presumably we couldn't have gotten swim bladders. It would not have been in the adjacent possible. I'll come back to that and show you some other examples. Or suppose that you're thinking about tigers. You couldn't get swim bladders. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we're saying is that we cannot pre-state the adjacent possible of the biosphere. We don't know what all the Darwinian pre-adaptations that could arise next, that's what I mean by adjacent possible,
right,
might be, okay?
Now, let me stop you for just a minute. What about the argument that maybe there is a way to sort of scientifically do all this, but it's beyond our capacity, our intellectual capacity as human beings?
Maybe that's true. I don't know. It certainly seems to be beyond our capacity. Let's suppose that it's conceivable that some other kind of creature can do it, but we can't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how could we know? Okay. Anyway, the point that I was about to make is it's not clear to me yet, one way or another, how we could have a mathematical framework for this adjacent possible. Maybe we can. Maybe we can't. If we could, maybe we could prove theorems about it and why we can't pre-state them. Okay, the adjacent possible. So that's just an unknown.
Okay.
Leave that hanging because nobody knows. I think we're on completely novel philosophic turf here. Okay, now let's look at the following. First of all, can we do what Newton told us to do? Newton said, think of a billiard table. You've got the billiard balls, and you've got Newton's laws. And so Newton says, look, identify your variables, the billiard balls. Now think of the laws among the balls, Newton's laws. Now think of the initial positions and velocities of all of the particles, namely the initial conditions, and then the boundary conditions, the walls of the billiard table. Okay?
Sure.
Now compute forward and see where the billiard balls go. Well, we can do that. Let's ask if we can do it for the biosphere. And the stunning answer is we can't, because we don't know that swim bladders are going to come into existence, or lungs, or spleens, or middle ear bones. In other words, the biosphere keeps popping up new things that we didn't know were going to come to existence. So how could we write down equations about them and solve for the forward evolution of the biosphere? We can't do it.
Because the conditions are always evolving in ways that we couldn't have imagined.
And the things that exist,
mm-hmm.
like lungs
right.
and swim bladders, pop up, so we don't know what the variables are beforehand. We don't know what the billiard balls are. So we can't do what Newton told us. And that's radical. The next thing is we can't even make probability statements about it, the evolution of the biosphere. At least I don't think we can. Flip a coin 10,000 times. It's going to come up heads about 5,000 times with a Gaussian, a Poisson distribution around that. But notice that we knew ahead of time all the ways that the heads or tails could come up. All heads, all tails, anywhere in between. Yeah?
Right.
We knew the space of possibilities, or what the statisticians call the sampling space. That's just what we do not know for the biosphere. We don't know what the space of possibilities is. So we can't make probability statements, at least not on the normal senses of probability.
Mm-hmm.
And here comes the most striking conclusion. What's a natural law? Well, you either think a law governs, say, how electrons move, like stoplights govern how we drive cars, and nobody thinks that. All scientists think that laws are, by the way, human descriptions that are compact descriptions of the regularities of a process, like Newton's laws. This is, for example, the view of Nobel laureate Marie Gell-Mann at the Santa Fe Institute, and I agree with it. Virtually everybody does. So you've got Newton's laws and Einstein's laws and so on. Chris, do you think that we could have a law, a compact description available beforehand of the evolution of swim bladders when we can't even pre-state the possibility of them?
Clearly we can't.
Right. So you've just come to the conclusion that I've come to that's so dramatic. It says we can't have laws for the evolution of everything in the biosphere. It's partially beyond natural law. This is an amazing conclusion if it's true. It may not be true. I think it is true. That doesn't mean no laws are followed. Nitrogen can't change into carbon in some molecule in your body. But we can't have a law for the evolution of the biosphere by Darwinian pre-adaptations. And in a moment, I'll say that the same thing is true in the economy and in our culture and so on.
Okay, well, let's stop for a moment, Stuart. What does that change about the way you view meaning in the world and in the universe?
All over the place.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we started by saying that the heart of reductionism and the Western scientific worldview is that when the science shall have been done, it'll turn out that everything is describable by natural laws. We've just decided that 400 years of Western scientific worldview is wrong. That's big, if it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it now means lots of things. By the way, one of the questions is, where does meaning come into the universe? In physics, there's only happenings. There's no doing, there's no agency, and there's no meaning. So part of what I talk about in the book is, where does agency come from? Like, you and I are having a conversation where you're interviewing me. We're both human agents. And I'm willing to think that a bacterium going up a glucose gradient is an agent. And it has meaning because when it either finds yuck or yum, and it matters to the bacterium.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I talk about that in the book. And once you've got that, you've got doing, like swimming up the glucose gradient, and you've got values, yuck or yum.
Right.
And once you've got that, you've got comparative values, and somewhere down the line, you've got meaning. In fact, you've got meaning right there. It means something to the bacterium, whether it's conscious or not. Downstream from that, you get human morality, where we're trying to decide what we ought to do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So now your question was, what does all this have to do for, you know, what does it mean, right? Is that your question?
Yes.
Okay. It means lots of things, Chris. First of all, we're into an entirely new scientific worldview. It means that we're going to have to replace reductionism by a totally new understanding of who we are in the universe. So here's the next big step. If we truly don't know what's going to happen, if you want me to, I'll give an example. Can I give an example about the economy?
I think you've been dying for this. Yes, give us an example about the economy.
Okay, so this is supposed to be a true story. Some engineers are trying to invent a tractor. This is a true story. They know they're going to need a massive engine block. They get one and they mount it on a chassis. It breaks the chassis. They keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger chassis. It keeps breaking all of them. Finally, one of the engineers says, you know, the engine block is so big and rigid, we can use the rigidity of the engine block and hang everything off the engine block and use it as the chassis. And that's how tractors are made.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a Darwinian pre-adaptation. It's using the rigidity of the engine block for a novel function. See it?
Yeah. So you had the engine first and without the need necessarily for a chassis or anything else hanging off of it. Right.
Right. So that's a Darwinian pre-adaptation. They happen all the time in the evolution of the economy. most inventions are used for things other than that for which they were initially invented. So let's look at it in the economy. When the computer was invented to solve projectile trajectories, do you think anybody foresaw word processing, the internet, internet commerce, and Facebook?
No, because other technologies that led to those things hadn't evolved yet.
Right, and they all, and in fact, most inventions are used for purposes other than that for which they were originally invented. There are also pre-adaptations that fit together. I'm sitting in Silicon Valley with my cousin, who's been watching precisely these kinds of pre-adaptations happen in the emergence of Silicon Valley over the past 30 years or 40 years. So the same thing is true in the economy, with the same notion of the adjacent possible, by the way. Well, I'll come back to that if we have some time, because I know that we're a little crushed for time. But this means the following. It means that reason alone, since we don't know what's going to happen, for example, in the economy, it means that reason, the highest human virtue of the Enlightenment, is an insufficient guide for living our life. It means we have to unite reason, emotion, intuition, allegory, story, narrative, however it is that we manage to live in the face of mystery, to use Gordon Kaufman's wonderful phrase. We don't know what's going to happen. We live into the unknown. We do it all the time. We don't know how we do it. So one of the things that I think we need to take on is understanding how do we do it. I was just talking to Jan Rivkin at Harvard Business School, and Jan tells me that that in the strategy program at Harvard Business School, there's no methodology whatsoever in terms of strategy and business strategy. They just hope people get good at it. So that's because when you're really running a business, you don't know what's going to happen. And you have to use whatever tools you've got to make your decisions, but you're not going to write down an equation for it. You're going to do something much richer than anything that we've dreamed. So the next thing that it means is that since that's true, when Shakespeare says to us, through Lady Macbeth, out, out, damned spot, we know exactly what Lady Macbeth is thinking. I mean, her husband just killed the king. And Shakespeare is telling us the truth. So science no longer has a hegemony on the truth. Science is true. Shakespeare is telling the truth. History tells us the truth. Plumbers tell us the truth. So what this means is that we have to expand and reunite our entire humanity and spread out across all of our humanity how we manage to be human and live in a world where it is no longer the case that when the science shall have been done, we're going to know everything, because we're not. We're still going to live in the face of mystery. And Chris, I think we don't have the faintest idea of what all of this may mean to us. I think it's world-changing if this is true. And we're going to have to think for a long time.
Stuart A. Kaufman is my guest. His new book is called Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Lots of folks want to talk to you, Stuart, so we will speak now to Robbie in Plano. Hi, Robbie.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Chris. The genius of Darwin didn't serve him very well when he decided to come up with a name for this amazing discovery that he had made. And perhaps that's the reason why people continue to believe that this is only a theory in spite of the overwhelming evidence to support it. Now, with that as a background, I'm actually amazed that there are debates every now and then around the country about including creationism in the school curriculum. And my question is, do you also have these debates in Canada, or are you aware of other...
First of all, I'm American. I happen to be living in Canada right now.
Well, I'm just curious if these kind of petitions and some of these efforts to include creationism is also prevalent in other parts of the world.
No, it's predominantly in the United States. There's none of it in Canada. I've been there for 3 years. There's none of it in Europe, and we need to understand. First of all, let me say as a scientist, evolution as a fact is as well established as any other scientific fact that exists. You would have to give up so many other aspects of science to not think that evolution occurred. You'd be stunned. The reason that people want creation science is to be listened to with empathy. The real thing that's going on is the fear on the part of many who are religious that without God's authority to tell us what is moral, we would have no morality and Western civilization would more or less crumble. They're wrong. And the reason that they're wrong is that we already know that the great apes show evidence of morality. Morality is something that has evolved itself. So evolution is not the enemy of morality, it's the first source of morality. That doesn't mean that that's the end of the story. Human morality is much richer and more nuanced than those of the higher primates. But we don't have to be afraid of evolution. We don't need God to be moral. Another proof of it is that Buddhists don't have a God and they think they're moral. So this fear on the part of so many Americans, which is the most religious country in the first world, is totally misplaced.
My guest is Stuart A. Kaufman. He is founding director of the Institute for Biocomplexity and Informatics and a professor at the University of Calgary. His new book is called Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can call 1-800-933-5372 to join us or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stuart A. Kaufman. His new book is called Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. So, Stuart, you explained for us how there can be morality without a deity. You also believe that there is human spirituality without a deity.
I do indeed. Let me get to this in a couple steps.
Okay.
Our sense of God has evolved over the years. Yahweh, I happen to be Jewish, and Yahweh, he was our idea. Mm-hmm. He was a warrior, law-giving God. The God of which Jesus spoke and became in part of the Trinity is a different God. It's a God of love. So our sense of God has evolved, and in fact it's evolved over the past 100,000 years in many ways. I want to go back to Gordon Kaufman's distinction between the creator and the creativity. In the place of law, if things are partially lawless, as I think we've agreed to, I think that what we're looking at is a staggering creativity in which the biosphere literally constructs itself. So does our economy, although there we have to think about human consciousness. But we don't for the biosphere. It's just this amazing ongoing creativity in which what comes into existence reshapes what's around, which changes the adjacent possible, which changes what comes into existence in a way that we don't understand at all. So there's a stunning, ongoing, ceaseless creativity, at least in the biosphere on up through human culture. maybe in the abiotic universe as well. I'm thinking hard about that.
And you can attach the word God to this ceaseless creativity in the biosphere.
That's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's our choice whether or not we want to use the God word. It's the most powerful symbol we have. We know why secular humanists who remember Galileo and don't want to use the God word don't want to use the word, because in their view, it's so besmirched with evil that they don't want to use it. And we know why people who believe in a supernatural God do want to use it, because they find solace and meaning and orientation for their lives, and there's much beauty in religion. And I would never say to anyone who believes in God that they shouldn't do so. I think it's wonderful. I happen not to. But I think we can take on a new sense of God as the natural creativity in the universe. This is Gordon Kaufman's view, that God is creativity. I just happen to have found the scientific argument that supports Gordon Kaufman at Harvard's theological views. But let me say a few quasi-theological things as a non-theologian. Suppose that you're a normal Christian believing in a theistic God who acts in the universe as an omniscient and omnipotent and all-loving. Well, you still have the problem of evil. And this view doesn't say that everything that happens is good. Extinction events happen, and my daughter was killed 21 years ago. That was horrible. Bad things happen. Now, if we take the normal theistic view, we could nevertheless say there is this ceaseless creativity in the universe that God created, and we can be awestruck by it and find it worthy of awe and respect. So you don't have to give up your belief in God to be stunned by the creativity in God's universe. That's theological view one.
Mm-hmm.
The second is you could take the stance that very creativity that I'm speaking of in the lawlessness could be God acting in the universe. I don't believe that at all, but I think that that's a possible view. Third, we can just give up the creator and keep the creativity as our sense of God. So God becomes now the fully natural creativity in the real world. What I love about this, Chris, is it totally ends the tension between reason and faith, or science and religion. It's gone. God now is what's out there in reality. This is a God that's not an agent. We cannot pray to it. It cannot answer our prayers, but we can love it. And let me tell you a little personal story that I think begins to get it across. I live in a little village outside of Calgary, next to a stream and a hill. And last summer I was looking at the hill. It's covered with spruce and aspen. And I thought to myself, you know, I could cut down those trees if I wanted to. And then, meaning the God that I mean, the natural creativity in the universe that brought all this forth, I said, but that's God's work. How dare I cut down those trees? I'd better have a very good reason. Then I looked at the stream and I said, I could dam that stream if I want to. I can't. It's Queen's Country in Canada. But I said to myself, that's God's work. How dare I dam that stream? I'd better have a very good reason. So what I think this view of God as a creativity in the universe invites, it doesn't command, it doesn't demand, it simply invites, is this amazing sense of membership in all of the creativity around us, including all of the biosphere and the planet. And that brings us to what's sacred. So let's think of all the gods we've worshipped in the past 100,000 years or 5 million years. There's a very, very, very large number. Our gods have always told us what is sacred. You begin to get the suspicion, if you look at all of our religious beliefs in the past 100,000 years, that maybe we've been telling our gods what is sacred, and then they've been telling us what we told them. I believe this is right. I think it's always been us talking to ourselves. I don't think that's bad at all. I think it's wonderful. It means that we humans have an innate sense of what is sacred. The question is, at this stage in the evolution of human culture, will we now take on, consciously and on purpose, choosing those values that we deem most important and worthy of being held sacred? I think that we can and should. Will we all agree with one another? Well, no. It's going to be like any other moral argument. But I think that we can make progress on it. So I think that we can develop a sense of the sacred that includes all of life in the planet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. An email from Jeff says, please speak to the theory of self-reproducing inflationary universes versus the Big Bang. We have like 5 minutes left, but maybe
you
can...
Well, the answer is that it's not my expertise. The inflationary view follows the Big Bang. And so you get the Big Bang, then you get an inflationary enormous growth in the size of the universe that explains why the universe is homogeneous. And please go talk to a good physicist.
Stuart, the interesting thing about your idea of the God as being the creative force in the universe is that it really does, and we decide for ourselves what is sacred, is that it puts a greater responsibility almost on humankind to make the right choices.
That's right. It makes us responsible. It makes us adults, which is not to say that people who believe in God aren't, but it makes us responsible. And it means also, Chris, you see, that we can use the sense of the sacred to try to invent a global ethic. Right now, think of the United States. Take the secular humanists like myself who don't believe in God. What do we take to be valuable? Well, love of family, fairness and love of friends, obeying the law, democracy is good, and free markets are the way to go. We've been commoditized in the United States and in the First World in modern society. How strange we would look to medieval Europe, let alone to the Islamic world or much of the rest of the world. We need to invent a global ethic. And we need to invent it, Chris, because a global civilization is emerging. Due to globalization of commerce and communications, we are crushing our civilizations together. People are retreating into religious fundamentalisms. The religious right in the United States was left behind, a game that urges kids to kill those that they cannot convert to the rapture. Well, that's morally obscene. It's as bad as the Wahhabists who are actually killing kids by, you know, strapping on bombs. Not quite as bad, but morally it's as bad.
Well, we don't see a lot of American fundamentalist Christians running around killing people they
no,
can't
that's
convert.
Right, we don't. But the notion in the game, there's a game that was on sale at Walmart called Left Behind, from the books Left Behind, and what it said was to a 15-year-old playing the game, try to convert me, a good Episcopalian, to be a religious fundamentalist. If you succeed, you get points. If you don't, you pull out your shotgun and kill me. That's terrible, Chris.
Do you think of traditional religion and the structures that created as a device that humankind needed to get to this stage in our cultural evolution? Could we have gotten here if we hadn't had that thinking in our past?
Yes, I do. And furthermore, I think that it would be a mistake, a profound mistake, to give up the wisdom in our diverse religious traditions. I think what we need to do is let them evolve together and maybe examine this new sense of God and see what will become. There's a lot of embodied wisdom in our religious traditions. Religion isn't bad. By and large, it's wonderful. And those who argue that standard religions are evil are missing all the good that religion does in the world. And I, for one, would never argue that at all. But if we've evolved our sense of God, we can keep evolving our sense of God. I do want, in the remaining minute, to make what I think is a fundamental point.
Sure.
The last thing in the world that we need is a single, rigid sense of morality or God. We need to have ways of evolving our sense of what is sacred in a way that is wise, because it's going to change over time. The best model that I know of this is British common law, which has evolved since the Magna Carta, stays alive by precedents that ramify through the law and change the law, so that over time and with some accumulated wisdom, the congealed moral views of the British evolve. So we can create institutions that are capable of evolving wisely our own morality and our own sense of the sacred. And I think that that's something else that we have to think about. Chris, what I'm really trying to get started is a conversation. Well, started is maybe presumptuous, but I think we need conversations on a bunch of fronts. First of all, I think that if I'm right about Darwinian pre-adaptations, we totally need to rethink what it means to be humans in the world. I think we need a new enlightenment that we can only begin to get glimpses of. I think we need to reinvent the sacred. I think we need to evolve our sense of God to include the possibility that one sense of God is, as I said, the creativity in nature itself.
As you move around through this country and this culture specifically, do you get the idea, Stuart, that people are hungry to reinvent this, or are they a little bit scared of the concept?
I don't know, Chris. My book has just been published. It's a really risky book. But I think that we need to think about this. Do I think that millions of people are going to say yes? I don't know. I think that there's lots of people who are profoundly religious who will not want to alter their beliefs at all. And a lot of people, about a billion of us in the globe, don't believe in a supernatural God. Those of us who feel that way may find this more congenial. I think this is a 50 to 100-year conversation. I don't think it's going to be fast, nor do I think it should be fast. I think it should be the considered wisdom of all of us as we reason and intuit and feel together.
What do you think the practice of religious worship might evolve into? If everyone on the planet were to start thinking the way you did, what would happen to that tradition of worship?
Well, I've begun to think about it, Chris. Let's notice, first of all, that religion is partially a community and partially ritual. We need that. And how that might happen, I don't know. But another part of it is, if we take on understanding ourselves in this world where reductionism fails, where we live in a world where we do not know what's going to happen, but we muddle through anyway using all the tools that we've got, and science won't answer all the questions, and isn't the only way to try to answer the question, then understanding our whole humanity and how we live our whole human lives is going to become the preeminent question. And interestingly enough, religion
Stuart,
is...
I'm so sorry that we're out of time. Stuart A. Kaufman's new book is called Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. Stuart, very interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.